Today's Tuesday, July 11th. Wow, July's going by really fast. This week's news is terrible.
Yep. Not much going on in the news this week. The summer doldrums seem to affect everything. Now, we do need to mention that we have, through investigative journalism, we've tracked down all the German ship posters from last week. We have their identity. We have their details. We're not going to release it, but we do reserve the right to do so if this behavior continues.
We've got a lot of follow-ups this week and a lot of really interesting stories.
We don't have a lot of interesting stories. That's a lie.
That's fake news. Oh, we've got very meta. It's very meta fake news. I don't know. AT&T is saying forced arbitration isn't forced because no one has to buy service from AT&T. So this is sort of an interesting investigation here in America because senators are saying, wait, don't most people have to buy AT&T if you're in an AT&T area for telecommunications service?
Now, this goes back to, I think it was last week, maybe the week before, we talked about if you sign this contract with AT&T to get the service, then you may not sue them. That's not allowed.
You got to go into arbitration.
It's forced arbitration. It is forced arbitration. And AT&T hires the arbitration. So it rules in their favor almost all the time. Some senators read the same story that we did, and they said, hey, wait a minute. This isn't right. You shouldn't be doing this. And, of course, AT&T responds, no, it's not forced. You don't have to get the service.
Now, you know, I guess in some parallel universe, if there were a lot of competing telecommunication companies, it might be reasonable to choose a different communications company if you don't like the practices of a particular company. But telecommunications companies in America are some of the lowest rated in the world for customer service. Like, everyone universally thinks that their communications company provider, especially if it's Comcast, you know, Cox, AT&T, Verizon, etc., are consistently some of the lowest rated among consumers. You know, it's like they're just, you know, Byzantine, draconian, just crazy policies and processes. So this is sort of being looked into, I guess. But the other thing to consider is that in a lot of regions where AT&T operates, they are given a monopoly to operate in that geographical region. It's called a franchise. And so we sort of looked at it and said, well, it doesn't make sense for three companies to build out competing infrastructure. The cost of building that infrastructure would make it unviable for three companies to build out, two or three or four companies or whatever, to build out full infrastructure to service a limited market. So cities and towns and regions will offer franchise agreements where a company comes in and agrees to provide service to everybody. You know, at whatever, you know, fair market rates, it's usually defined pretty nebulously. So it's a little disingenuous, I think, for AT&T to make this argument, and some senators see that the same way.
The argument is not, should you use AT&T or another service? The argument is, should you use the internet or not? And that's not really much of a choice in today's age. I mean, you could get by without it, sure, but this is America. We're American exceptionalism, and yet we're okay with some people just not having the internet because they're not willing to sign this crazy contract.
It's a bit like arguing that, you know, you can get by and, you know, live in America without being able to read.
Yeah, it's in a day and age where you do a lot of, like, registrations online for things like your car, you do tax-related things, you do a lot of, you know,
just participate in society.
Yeah, the little things that the government nags you about. There's probably still some other way to do it, but to say that people just shouldn't have access is ridiculous.
And go live in a cabin in the woods with a typewriter and mail things to people. I mean, you can do that without the internet.
You definitely aren't allowed to do that anymore. Because if you don't have, like, water processing and power structure, they'll be like, no, this is condemned.
This is condemned. You can't live here. Wow, that would be amazing. It's like, this building can't get reasonable internet. Has it been condemned?
And unless you prove that you have internet and AT&T is your only choice, wow, that would be amazing, wouldn't it? I could totally see that happening.
Also, in a follow-up, the Petya ransomware author has released the master decryption key. So the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about the NotPetya ransomware, which looks like an adaptation or a hack job of that ransomware from last year. But this year's variant of that does not have any kind of decryption capabilities. It looks like it's just overriding everything as opposed to actually encrypting everything. So the original author of this malware has released the master decryption key.
Previously, he had attempted to get like a one-time payment. I can't remember how much he wanted. I think it was like hundreds of thousands. say, hey, just somebody give me this. I will give you the master decryption key, and then there'll be no more Petya. Anybody that's infected will be fine. I don't think anybody took him up on that, but now I think it's back in the news, and somebody stole his work, so he's just like, okay, fine, here it is.
I think also the fact that this work has been co-opted and turned into something even more insidious than ransomware, something that you know, deletes all of your stuff, may have been a motivating factor there as well. So was that a nation-state attack or whatever? We don't know, but it is nice that the decryption key is there. Of course, you have to have saved your hard drive from last year if you got encrypted and you didn't do anything with it in order to be able to decrypt it now.
Maybe. If you get affected by one of these current ones, be sure and clone the hard drive. So, you know, maybe 2 years from now, somebody will take pity and release the master key.
Oh, speaking of pity, people taking pity and releasing things, the CIA apparently has a lot of really amazing tools for stealing your SSH credentials across a variety of platforms. Now, this is not quite as alarmist as it sounds. This is more like, hey, we've got some tools for stealing your stuff that are pretty neat. But most of it's not, all of these tools are not remotely exploitable or in to do with remote exploits. They're all local exploits, which means somebody already has to have access to your system in order to do this.
Now, these can steal your SSH password, your keys, or a combination of both. It pretty much monitors everything you do on SSH. So somebody does have to physically access your machine and plant this. They also have to physically access your machine to get it back out because it doesn't phone home or anything. So, you know, it's not a huge threat, but to the people who have like really interesting SSH traffic and public systems, stuff like that, pretty alarming.
The other interesting thing is that all of the stuff that it logs locally is encrypted, so that will help it evade system scans. If you're periodically search your system for, you know, passwords or things that should not be in plain text files or things that should not be in a readily searchable format, the format that it stores the information in is encrypted, so it's not going to be readily apparent that it's a key logger or a session logger or anything else like that to a lot of common scanning utilities. Also in decryption and OMG, whatever, satellite phones. So if you're going to Everest anytime soon, definitely don't plan your next robbery.
Yes, this is, so this encryption that the major manufacturer of sat phones has used was compromised in 2012, but this attack does it much, much faster, and it uses the plain text that it can figure out about what's being passed to quickly target different parts and decrypt faster. So almost in real time, by the time you say hello, someone could be listening in on your satellite conversation.
Yeah, it's only a 64-bit key, but the attack here, it reads like it's a little bit of a side channel attack, but basically they're reducing the 64-bit key space even further based on known parameters of the conversation. So depending on, I guess, some stuff in the handshake protocol or whatever, they're able to eliminate a lot of the key space that they would have to search. So you get basically a real-time result. So, hey, satellite phones, not secure anymore. Who knew? Now you do. It's fine. Oh, my goodness. Systemd. Systemd is in the news. Again, not for being controversial, for being insecure. A couple of different systemd vulnerabilities this week. One is if you have a user ID that begins with a number, apparently systemd assumes that you're root because that's a thing. And two, if you have a specially crafted DNS response that you send to systemd's DNS lookup service, you can execute arbitrary code.
Doesn't affect a ton of systems. I think only Ubuntu really is affected, and there are patches already. But, you know, why risk it?
Red Hat was immune just because of some stuff that they had done. Debian happened to be immune because they used such fantastically ancient versions of Debian. I think that one of the unreleased versions of Debian might have been vulnerable, but they have since patched that and dealt with it and whatever. So Debian happened to be immune because of their ultra-conservative practices, which, hey, that's how Debian operates. Woohoo! So, good job. I'm not sure if other distributions are vulnerable. Just, log into your systems, update them, make sure it's fine. It's like systemd. Mostly we just include this to point and laugh at systemd. I don't want to cover this next story. Facebook in Germany? No, I've had enough Germany. We don't need any more Facebook Germany personal information. No, let's just talk about, I don't know, what, like My Little Pony? I don't know, something crazy, something other than this.
Those Germans, they love to post. Now, this is sort of reminiscent of the AT&T story. It's kind of the same argument, except Facebook isn't even making an argument. This is the German government who's saying that because Facebook is so important for your social lifestyle, for, you know, existing in Germany, that you're forcing people to agree to these crazy data collection practices just to participate in the social media world. And that's not okay.
So that's kind of like the AT&T thing with arbitration, sort of, kind of, but the opposite side.
But where you can make the argument, I think, that it is important to have internet access. I don't think it's important to have Facebook access. There are so many other social networks, and you don't have to use a social network. You can communicate through other means on the internet. There's such a variety of ways. It doesn't seem right to say Facebook is not a need. That is not I think you need to get Facebook out of your life.
It seems to be that the argument, if I'm understanding correctly, on the European side of things, is that it is tantamount to some type of commerce transaction where Facebook will not give you access. It sort of locks you out unless you agree to give them your information, because I guess that has value in it. And so in that sense, maybe it is a commerce transaction to where... And the European argument is you should be able to participate without giving them your information as currency.
This doesn't make a lot of sense, but it is true, and it is a good thing to keep in mind. They're right about this, that Facebook, you basically are giving them something of value. They are tracking everything that you do, and they're selling it, and they're making a ton of money doing it. A ton of money. I think they had like $47 billion revenue. And, you know, it's all this AI they've got figuring out all these different things about you based on your browsing habits. Also, keep in mind, if you're logged into Facebook, every page that has a like button, which is every page in the universe, knows who you are on Facebook, and it's keeping track of what you're doing.
Oh, I mean, most people do not realize the danger of being manipulated if somebody has a psychological profile on you. It is astonishingly easy to manipulate somebody if you've got a psychological profile on them. I know that not because of anything modern, but the modern advertising industry is built on that kind of thing, and that's a whole other fascinating sort of story. It's like a, you know, subtle social cues, and it's like this person is doing this, and so you should too. And it's like whoa, we need to harden the populace against those kinds of attacks. That's not good.
And we saw the story about the teenagers, where Facebook was like, let's figure out when teenagers are the most depressed. Because you advertise to people when they're depressed, it works amazingly well. And so they were like, okay, we're going to step back from that. But don't forget that they did it. They were in a boardroom somewhere, and they were like, that seems like a good idea. Let's explore that.
Let's explore an algorithm that finds depressed teenagers, because those are the ones that buy stuff.
Exactly.
Speaking of news stories that make your skin crawl... the EFF has this amazing write-up. This is one of the best articles that I have read in a long time. It really stands out. You really, if you're interested in DRM and the open web and Tim Berners-Lee and some of the rationale, Cory Doctorow has really, I mean, this is one of his best pieces of writing, and it's really not a long read. The short version here is the W3C consortium is looking at adopting, and basically has agreed to adopt, DRM into a web standard. And, you know, on the face of it, you know, we need Netflix, their videos, the rights holders require DRM. And on the face of it, maybe if you squint your eyes, DRM would be acceptable, but you need to carve out some exceptions. I had no idea, but the EFF and the W3C had actually been working together for months, if not years, to carve out some of those exceptions. And none of those have been accepted for reasons that I don't believe are legitimate.
The most important exception is security research. So DRM, you're not allowed to look under the hood. That's illegal. Because it's like, oh, no, this is rights management. If you look under the hood, you're trying to get past it, and that's not okay. But the EFF is saying, well, hang on. We need to look under the hood just to make sure that there's not a security or a privacy issue here. Are you spying on us with the DRM? Is the DRM leaving us open to some sort of terrible attack? Someone needs to be able to look at that and say, hey, I'm just looking at this because of these reasons. I'm not trying to get past it. And so there was talk about, like, okay, that kind of makes sense. But
there's no criminal intent to get past it.
Ultimately, after all those talks, they were just like, you know what? Those have all been overruled. No one looks under the hood. No one does anything to get past this. it is unassailable or it's illegal.
There are other legit reasons for bypassing DRM, including accessibility, you know, hearing impaired, visually impaired. The best argument really is like two lines in the article, and I'll do a really bad job paraphrasing, but it is, you know, you have a right, you as a consumer have a right to do certain things with copyrighted material. And if DRM is in place on the copyrighted material, then that deprives you of rights that you would have with that material were it not for the DRM. So like transcoding your music, you know, you've got your analog audio CD collection that you want to transcode to a digital player. Well, you would no longer be able to transcode that media if it were protected by some type of DRM mechanism at all. There are no exceptions. Now, the other really interesting thing here is that in order to participate in the W3C consortium, the W3C can ask you to agree in a binding way for certain provisions. So under the law, you know, there are no exceptions under the law. But that's not necessarily a bad thing, because the EFF and the W3C early on were talking about saying, well, in a binding way, you guys agree not to prosecute people that are, you know, reverse engineering for security purposes or reverse engineering for whatever. And so even though that's still illegal under the law or still something that could be prosecuted under the law, the actual rights holders have contractually agreed not to do that. And that is, in fact, how a lot of standards are adopted by the industry. So like if some companies that own patents on new technology show up and they say, hey, we want everybody to use this as a standard, they don't give up the rights to their patent. They just enter a consortium like this, and all the participants and everybody that uses the standard as defined by the consortium can use those patents. This is also a really important defensive mechanism, because when you look at things like Microsoft has done in the past to adopt a standard and to embrace a standard and then extend it in proprietary and weird ways, and that causes fragmentation and problems, and then the standard is not well used, this sort of mechanism protects against that. And so that seems like an entirely reasonable way of dealing with a DRM on the web, but that's been rejected wholesale. I don't know, the mind reels. You should go read the article, it's really good. We've also got to talk about the State Department doing fake stuff on Twitter. What's going on with Hollywood and the State Department making fake tweets about yay copyright and yay intellectual property?
This is such a bizarre story. And they did a very poor job of hiding it, almost as if they weren't trying to, so...
Was that wrong? Should we not have done that?
I don't
Those are always the most fascinating.
I don't think they understood exactly. So this is really, it's really kind of hard to follow exactly, because it's sort of like you look sideways at it and it still doesn't make any sense. But they came up with this idea. They wanted to do a fake Twitter feud. Now, of course, we know the Twitter feud is huge. It'll get you on TMZ. If you're famous, you know, it'll be covered by major papers now. Major papers will talk about, remember the thing where it was... the CIA, it was the early time, like WikiLeaks had just come out with all that stuff. And one of the big papers, might have been the New York Times, covered nothing about the, you know,
they're just talking about Twitter.
Yeah, the vulnerabilities. They didn't tell you anything about what it did or whatever. The whole story was about Assange and the CIA having a Twitter war. So, you know, you can get in the news with this. So they had planned a fake Twitter feud in order to sort of advertise this, you know, intellectual property rights and stuff like that. The feud wasn't going to be like, I think it's wrong and I think it's right. The feud was going to be like, I'm more into it than you are. And the Recording Industry Association and the Motion Picture Association was involved, and they were trying to recruit like people from Harvard and stuff like that. It's a very bizarre story.
There are a lot of law students from Harvard that we think would be really into this whole intellectual property thing. One of the things in there was that Ben Franklin invented bifocals, and it's like that makes them hip to intellectual property law. And it's like, guys, I got news for you. That was so long ago that that's no longer relevant, because anybody can make bifocals now.
Also, didn't Ben Franklin, like, wasn't his stuff all open because he didn't believe in?
Yeah.
So these are marketing people. They don't know what the hell's going on. They're just like, you know what would be a brilliant idea? You know what would really set a fire under this? Let's start a Twitter feud. And everybody in the room was like, that's brilliant, because they're all morons.
Verizon is cutting off heavy data users in rural areas. So this is kind of a non-story, but then you read into it and you find out the technical stuff here, and then you say, oh, that makes much more sense. So in previous stories, we reported that Verizon is moving the unlimited users, cutting off unlimited users that are on their plan, moving them to other plans, but then they've recently reintroduced unlimited with some asterisks and limitations and things like that for their plan, just sort of recap the last 6 months to a year with Verizon, because they're kind of, it seems like they're kind of waffling, but when you really look at it, they're not actually waffling. They're implementing a carefully structured plan. And this is another component of that plan. And that plan is to basically turn data into something that's rationed, into something that, you know, is controlled and that sort of thing. So Verizon recently reintroduced, quote unquote, unlimited. But unlimited now doesn't mean the same thing as it did then. And unlimited in this case means it's good speeds for a while, and then they throttle you back to almost nothing. In this case, they're throttling users that are using LTE on a peer's network, because Verizon has no ability to throttle on someone else's network. So the plan right now is that, you know, once you've exceeded 22 gigs on this unlimited plan, limited really means 22 gigs, they don't cut you off outright or start billing you. They just throttle your speed back to not very much. But there are some other providers with which Verizon has an agreement for LTE service. And so if you look on your phone, it'll say you're on Verizon's network, but you're not actually on Verizon's network, especially in some of these rural areas. And because Verizon doesn't control the third-party provider's network and it's got a peering agreement with them, it can't throttle those heavy users, and so it's just cutting them off. Meanwhile, Cox is also expanding their home internet data caps, and CenturyLink is getting rid of them. So this is all to do with the whole FCC net neutrality, you know, whatever.
Five more states. Cox has gone into five more states, and now they are giving you 1 terabyte per month.
Oh, they're so generous.
Yeah, if you go over that 1 terabyte, every 50 gigabytes will cost you $10. Now, if you think they're not merciful gods, they will give you, for an extra 50 a month, pure unlimited.
Really, really unlimited?
Yeah.
So do they, if you go over 50 gigabytes, would that be the equivalent? And then after that, they just don't count it anymore? Because that would be how they ought to do it.
No, if you do 51 gigabytes, that's $20.
Those bastards. Why? Why do they do this? Why is this allowed?
It's money? Not, it's just greed? They're allowed to?
That's like saying, we're going to charge you, $20 for up to 1,000 gallons of water. But then if you use another 50 gallons of water, we're going to charge you another $20. And it's like, well, this doesn't make sense. This is crazy. But then if you use another 100 gallons of water, then it's unlimited? I don't know.
We had the story last week about how all of the arguments for throttling and data caps have been soundly debunked. None of them make any sense. Every time they make an argument for it, it's just like, no, that's not real, and here's why. So they're just not making excuses anymore. They're just like, no, this is how it is, and you're going to deal with it. And now they're doing it in five more states.
But CenturyLink has abandoned their caps because I guess they're planning on using traffic shaping and that sort of thing, which is okay. Like, under existing net neutrality, if the network is busy and you need to implement traffic shaping in order to deal with that, that is totally okay. What is not totally okay is the network is not very busy. We're going to slow you down to dial-up speeds as a punitive measure. That is not okay.
But also, we have to remember that in most parts of the world, this is not a thing. And even with our aging infrastructure, this doesn't need to be a thing.
No.
It's purely for money. It's purely to get, you know, just to wring a few more dollars out of you every month. It exists because it works, and they get away with it.
I really wish that some of the people that are voting on these kind of things in bureaucracy, especially in Australia, had the chance to travel to, like, Asia or even Canada. Not necessarily. I mean, depending on where you are in Canada and some other things, and parts of Europe, because they could experience what infrastructure, like, good infrastructure really is. We're definitely moving backwards. And, man, Australia, you guys are already, like, almost at rock bottom, and you're just, I don't see any signs of improvement. I mean, it's just, it's bad. It's real bad.
You could send them wherever you want to send them. You could send them to the secret Martian base where they have, you know, the fastest internet in the universe. It's not going to matter, because when they get that check from Comcast or that check from Cox next month, they're going to be like, oh, I'm voting this way.
Yeah, my fundamental assumption was they're not already horribly corrupted by money, which I guess is probably wrong. Yay, cynicism. We don't really have a good story for it. But there is also this sort of procedural thing that's happening with the net neutrality rollback. So this is the National Hispanic Media Coalition has requested that the FCC delay doing anything with net neutrality as it is, because they filed a Freedom of Information request to know what the public comments are, all of them, on net neutrality. And the FCC has to respond to that. And so this is sort of a bureaucratic procedural thing, but this should delay the vote on net neutrality. So if the FCC is going to follow its own rules on procedure, we're going to know soon.
Now here's, I have an idea here. This is some, this is a way that social justice could actually benefit society.
No, I don't believe that.
So no, but check it out. We take, you know how it's been like, you know, we've divided up humanity into a billion little pockets of, you know, like LGBTQ plus, you know, like that whole string. Every one of those little, you know, individual, we get the furries into it. we get the bronies into it. We'll get, you know, whatever, the neats. Every one of them files a petition. But like at the last day of when this one's about to run out, and we'll just play it on forever.
we'll take their bureaucracy and we'll make their bureaucracy 10 times worse. It's like we'll follow all the rules of bureaucracy and grind everything to a halt. What kind of government would that be? The kind of government where you basically get everything in place and then you drown everything with bureaucracy so that only the stuff that the vast majority agrees on can actually, you know, get pushed through.
I think it would be a short-lived government and one that ended in, you know, the National Guard being turned against the people.
Oh, we've got some technology. We're kind of meandering into quasi-technological news, but OneDrive, if you use OneDrive, which is Microsoft's, you know, cloud drive storage thing, has recently stopped working on non-NTFS drives. And the only reason we point and laugh at this is because Microsoft's comment on this was, oh, yeah, yeah, it was supposed to be like that all along. We don't know why it worked to begin with. Sorry.
Now, of course, if you have an older type of allocation, file system, then you can upgrade. There's a way. But if you've got the newer ones, there's no path back to NTFS. You're just, sorry.
Format.
Not going to happen.
Copy your files somewhere else and deal with it. It is very surprising that ReFS, Microsoft's new resilient file system, totally is not supported for OneDrive. I'm not sure why they would do that. But yeah, this is there must be some type of bug that had been found in the coming Windows 10 update for the fall. But yeah, if you're using OneDrive on anything but NTFS, it's not going to work now. And there are actually some people that use that with like SD cards and external drives, XFAT, which is a portable between operating systems to an extent. But yeah, all that's gone. NTFS only now.
And it's important to note there was no warning. You just woke up one day and it was like, sorry.
Oh, that was supposed to always be there. Yeah. It's like, but no, no. Why does this need to be here? No, you need a sunset period or something. It's not good. Are you into DIY and electronics, things like the Raspberry Pi? Well, there's the Nano Pi Neo Plus 2. It's $10 cheaper, but it's got gigabit Ethernet, a gigabyte of RAM, and a micro SD slot, and also onboard 8 gigs of eMMC. So it's perhaps a little bit more interesting than the Raspberry Pi 3, certainly with its gigabit connectivity, and a slightly smaller footprint.
It does not have HDMI, which is, it kind of removes a lot of the usefulness of it. And that memory is like the bottom of the barrel garbage can memory. Like it's the worst they could get. So it's pretty slow.
Yes, but you got a micro SD slot, so you can put more storage on it if you want. One of the example applications from the company is a NAS enclosure, and I think there's a $29 kit that you can get that would include a power adapter and an acrylic case and a heat sink, because apparently you can get a little bit more performance out of it if you put a heat sink on the CPU, which is pretty neat. You know what? I think we need another voice-activated assistant from Samsung. I think we need Samsung's Bixby speaker in a speaker format like Alexa. Said no one ever.
Now, the cool thing about this is those YouTube videos where they have them talk to each other. Now they can have a three-way conversation.
Have you guys seen those? If you guys haven't seen those, you should totally pause the news and go check out one of those. We should have had one of those ready for the news. But yeah, you can have Alexa talking to Siri, or Alexa talking to, you know, whoever. And it's just a conversation between chatbots. It turns dark really fast.
Now, the interesting thing about this is the company that did a lot of the work for Microsoft's solution here has actually since been purchased by Samsung. So Could get weird.
Is Bixie, are we looking at another, you know, Uber Waymo situation?
I think with so. Appropriate
technology?
Probably.
Bixby, stolen technology. That's the B. The B in Bixby comes from Bing. That's not exciting at all. I don't know. I don't know where I was going with that. But yeah, I just, you know, this is.
It's another thing we don't need.
It is yet another thing that we don't need. Why? Why do billion dollar companies do this? It's just like, I can't imagine that somebody that is so self-important that they're like, we need to be a part of your lives all the time. Oh, wait. Horrifying moment of introspection in 3, 2.
Well, I think the reason they want to get into it is because they see that, you know, everybody else is into it. And it's making money. That's
it's all about building that psychological profile and marketing to you. Apple is doing 3D face scanning to unlock the next iPhone. There've been a lot of rumors about the next iPhone and what all it's going to do. I don't know what to make of this because this article talks a little bit about the fingerprint recognition, which is like through the screen now, like it's behind the LCD and there's not a dedicated home button. And that to me is more interesting than the 3D face recognition. But I mean, I guess the 3D scanner stuff has shrunk to the point you could stick it in a phone conceivably.
Yeah, it's kind of like, what's so special about it? Well, the only thing that's special about it, because a lot of phones have done iris scanning before. Now, the problem with the iris scanning is it had no depth perception. So you could print a picture of an eye and it would be like, yeah, that works. But so this one is 3D. And supposedly that's going to prevent any 2D images from fooling this thing. So it must actually have depth to the picture. Who knows how accurate that'll be.
The article also claims that the 3D face scan has more points of data on which it bases recognition than a fingerprint scan. So just based on that, it's, I guess, theoretically more secure. But I mean, maybe the combination of technologies would be really good. But
it's important, very important to note that all of the legal stuff behind this, where we are right now is, so far you cannot be compelled to provide your passcode. But when it comes to your fingerprint, and I imagine your face is going to be the same thing, they don't have to have your permission. So they can force you to unlock those phones with those other kinds of unlock things. So if you're worried about, you know, the powers that be getting into your phone, you don't want this.
See, I actually see a much more insidious side of this technology. This is a way to sneak this in. If you do any kind of day trading or trade apps and a lot of banking apps, those apps will access your phone when you execute certain kinds of transactions, the camera on your phone, and take a picture. So I think that the 3D scanning face technology, I mean, it's possible that in the boardroom when they were planning this technology, it's like, you know, touch ID for authentication is not enough because somebody could use the fingerprint when they're passed out, or maybe the fingerprint could be lifted from somewhere else, or maybe there's not enough points of data. The insidious possibility here is that in that boardroom, they were like, okay, what if we took a 3D scan of their face, their fingerprint from the screen, and all this other data? It would basically be impossible for somebody to, you know, game the system or do a fraudulent transaction or whatever, because you not only get a 3D scan of somebody's face, you also get a picture. So you can see if they're conscious, you can see if they're awake, you can see what kind of environment they're in. And that's already happening in a lot of applications. The picture is not the 3D scan part of it.
So you're saying we need to market immediately a package of, like, you know, finger condoms and browsing face wrap for whatever you're going to be on your phone. So when the German Stasi comes and kicks down your door and they're like, you made this Facebook post. And you're like, I didn't do that. They're like, yes, you did. We got your face scan and we got your fingerprint right here.
Good. I mean, can you imagine the version of the news in like 2022? And it's like they track down the, you know, they track down the guy on the German Facebook that said something like, you know, yay, political party, whatever. And the reason they caught him is because they had a 3D scan of his face.
Yeah. It's just. Could definitely see that happening.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Waymo. Oh, I mentioned it. You know, speak the devil's name, and there they are.
It's, well, like, people get upset if we don't have an Uber story. So I think we missed it last week and maybe that week before that.
So the transcripts from this case are kind of interesting. Waymo has actually dropped 3 out of its 4 patent claims at the advice of the presiding judge, but they're still going to proceed with 10 or so, you know, protected intellectual property claims. But the guy that's involved, the guy that was hired from Google to go work for Uber, has pled the 5th, and so Uber will not be able to use him in their defense of this. So
he's also been fired. So he's out of the equation entirely. Now, the patents were not a big part of this case. They were just sort of like, you know, kick them while they're down type of thing. So the judge has actually been encouraging Waymo. It's like, look, just forget about these patents. This is not part of the deal. Let's deal with this other thing. And it's all about the LIDAR, and I can't remember what they call the other one.
Trade secrets.
It's about how the car is aware of its surroundings. That's the big thing. And so they're still saying they stole it. They're still going forward. They're just dropping some patent arguments.
It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, not just for the schadenfreude of, you know, Waymo and Uber, but there will be implications for this kind of thing in the rest of the tech sector. I mean, there is kind of, you know, opportunity for some of the people that are really advanced with technology to have some mobility between jobs, but things like this will prevent them from switching companies or doing anything really too dramatic, potentially, especially some of those higher level positions and especially some of those engineering positions. But also in terms of like intellectual property, it's like, is there such a thing as a generic LIDAR implementation? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but a lot of that's going to play out in this case. I don't think it's a good thing in the climate of the whole like Oracle versus Google and the whole Oracle API thing, because that was a bunch of BS from a computer scientist standpoint. But in terms of like the public and how caught up the court is on those kinds of things, it can have a lot of ramifications for the computing industry in general for these kinds of advanced technologies.
But also, got to keep in mind, when you're talking about standardization, we're talking about cars driving around the road here. If they're all speaking the same language, that's probably really good, because if you have, you know, two different algorithms deciding when to veer into each other, you know, I think if they were all on a standard, then most likely they would know how that other car is going to react and they could react accordingly. But if it's a big trade secret, like who knows what the Mercedes is going to do? Not us, because it's a trade secret, then that could create actual life-threatening situations.
If you want a good chuckle, you, the viewer, I want you to close your eyes and imagine a situation where in the future we've got three kinds of self-driving cars, Apple, PC, and Linux, and those cars' behavior are personified by those operating systems and how they act. And so it's just, there's no end of amusing things that you can come up with just a few minutes of imagination.
Is that amusing or is it terrifying?
Probably 60-40 on the terrifying side, but Microsoft is laying off thousands of its staff in a major global sales organization. Fortunately, it seems like this is mostly sales and not engineering, although Microsoft really hasn't super confirmed what's going on here. This other than to say that they're combining two of their management units, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's mostly enterprise sales. So they're focusing less on trying to sell, you know, these enterprise level products and stuff, and they're more about, you know, it's like, just give us money every month and shut up. I think that's the new plan.
Yeah, a lot of enterprises don't want to have to deal with software licensing either. So when Microsoft offers the whole subscription thing, it's no longer a capital expense. That's, you know, better for business. The license compliance stuff is super draconian at times. If you just do all that in the cloud, then it's really not much of a thing that you have to worry about anymore, which kind of, I guess, is attractive to the enterprise. But it also means you don't need sales staff keeping up with that stuff. It's just fill out a form, do it online, and you're done. So robots have taken those people's jobs is what I'm getting at. And if you know, whether you're a Microsoft salesperson or a strawberry farmer, robots are coming to a field near you.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn that strawberries are one of the most labor-intensive harvested plants.
That was the second most surprising thing for me. The first most surprising thing in this article is that people that are doing agriculture in Japan, the average workforce age is 70.
Well, they do have that demographic problem. So they don't really mention any specific technology here, but it's just how a lot of different places are looking at robot farming. You know, they're talking about robots doing all of the, you know, tilling the fields, planting the stuff, harvesting the stuff.
Weeding.
I saw a great video. Have you seen the video of the carrot harvester? It's just like, it's harvesting like, you know, 500, 600 carrots a second. It's incredible. And it's got these wheels that knock the dirt off of them, and then it whacks the top off and you just got beautiful carrots. It just goes down the road. So it doesn't make a lot of sense now, except in Japan, because those 70-year-olds don't work very fast. But it's getting better and better, and pretty soon it's going to be robots just doing all the farming, which is incredible.
Yeah, I mean, that's they said that for the strawberry farmers, one strawberry farmer buying a robot is not cost effective, but they were aware of a situation where like three different strawberry farms are sharing one robot, and that was an effective strategy for dealing with it. So you can imagine that a strawberry harvesting robot has got to be pretty delicate and fairly, I mean, like the cherry harvesters are crazy. They just grab a hold of the tree trunk and shake the crap out of the tree. I mean,
those are great to watch. Now, but you got to think though, I mean, your harvesting equipment, you probably use that how many months a year?
Yeah, not very much.
So most of the time it's just sitting around. So if you could come up with a way where, you know, you've got like a 3-week period and everybody staggers their harvest to come to, you know, like a certain time they're going to go ripe. That makes a ton of sense. Share them. Why not? You know, I mean, doesn't make any sense. If it's just going to be sitting there, that makes a ton of sense.
A strawberry harvesting robot co-op. This is the future, ladies and gentlemen. This is the future. Yeah. Oh, no. Also, if you're an Associated Press writer, I guess you should probably be scared because the Press Association has got a Google grant to run a news service with articles written by computer. These were local stories, which is the really surprising thing.
Well, of course, local and reporting doesn't really exist anymore. Most local papers just pull Associated Press and Reuters content and print it. That's all they do. And if something like really local happens, they might have one or two reporters that are going to go out and cover that, but they have very few, so a lot of stuff just doesn't get covered. And this, they didn't go into a ton of detail on exactly how this works, but I take it there's going to be like statistics. Like the government has to issue certain kinds of statistics on crime, on commerce, and things like that. And this AI is going to be able to take those numbers and actually fashion, you know, natural language, human readable stories about what's going on at a local level.
I think that would probably be insufficient to really address local news. I mean, pretty soon that AI is going to be pulling from what, like student newspapers at the local high school or random things that are posted on various local, you know, topical websites or whatever. It's like, you know, this is the corner of 4chan that's dedicated to, you know, Biloxi, Mississippi or whatever. And it's like, okay, well, I mean, I guess whatever.
But is it, well, there's a great, Conan O'Brien used to do this gag where those AP stories that local news, they pull down, they're like literally word for word. Everybody gets the same story. And he would take like clips of them reading the headline and it's like a joke, but everybody does the same joke and they don't change it at all. And it'll go through like 10 different ones and you're like, wow, that's hilarious. And then 2 minutes later, you're on number 30 and you're like, Jesus Christ, they're literally all just reading from a piece of paper. It doesn't change at all. So, I mean, real robots rather than human robots? Is that the argument here?
I think we must have gone into the wrong profession because we are both writing our own news and, like, so you're telling me we could just hire a talking head to do it and we don't have to do this anymore? I'm done. I'll see you later.
Well, writing, we don't write the news. That, CNN does that. We don't do that.
We point out the horrible absurdities, like stream ripping is the fastest growing music piracy. Like, I don't even.
Yeah, I thought we'd kind of gotten past the whole, like, okay, you lost. You've lost the ability to control the music. The music is free now. Go away. But no, even with streaming services, these guys are saying, hey, now that you've got streaming services, people are ripping that, and that's not okay. You're taking money from us.
So I think that, you know, if we were to do this in a conversational form with one of those guys, it would be like, so can you explain to us what stream ripping is? And they're like, well, it's when you go and you hit play on a stream of music and then it's playing on your device and you hear it in your ear. So you're ripping it from the speaker of the device and storing it in your ear. And that's stream ripping. And that's not allowed. We need to do something with that.
I don't think they go quite that far. But yes, there are services. Spotify is the big one. So there are the software. I think that might just be online services that do like an OAuth with Spotify. Just like, here, let's just rip all this for you. And they're very upset about that. And they want more laws, more restrictions to try and go after these people.
I'm not sure if this is something that is available in a widespread format on YouTube. But I think in the official YouTube app now, that for podcasts you like to listen to, and if you have YouTube Red, you can actually download all of those things to your device, you know, when you sleep or at night or whatever, and all of that will be available to you offline and will not use your data connection. Google's done this as a way to sort of combat the whole data caps things. I think originally Google engineers were like, no, we're just going to stream all that. It's going to be completely fine. But certainly with YouTube Red Music, you can listen to that offline now as well.
Yeah. There, I use the Google Play Music, and there is a certain amount of caching. So you can just allocate on your phone, on the settings, like use this much memory for caching, and it can always get to those songs, which is kind of annoying because it's set really high at first, and it's like, what is using all this memory? Oh, it's Google Play.
Yay, Google. But I don't really necessarily see this as a bad thing, especially if you're caching. I mean, you know, by and large, the music industry has won in terms of being able to, you know, be paid every time somebody listens to a song. I think that they are in a better position now than they were with CDs.
But, oh, no, not at all. Because they made so much money with CDs. They're not making nearly as much money with this.
Hmm.
But the thing about it is, they won the war with me with convenience. Because Google Play Music works in my car, works on my phone, and it works on my computer, and it's super convenient. And aside from, you know, some of the songs being missing, which you can fix by uploading your own version of it, it's more convenient than downloading MP3s and making my own, you know, putting it on a USB stick or SD card or something like that.
So it's kind of like the Steam model.
Yeah, exactly. That's, you win by making it convenient and giving the value of, like, okay, this is easier than stealing, but you still have to pay us. And when they do stuff like this, when they limit it, they're working in the wrong direction.
Yeah, they will not be satisfied until there is some inconvenient factor where it's like, well, I guess I'll have to put up with this horrible aspect of this, but yeah. I don't like it. It's like cable TV in that regard. It's the whole set-top box thing. It's like, if you want cable TV, you got to suffer through these awful, terrible design set-top boxes.
Which is, of course, why cable TV is nearly dead.
Switching back to Australia, Elon Musk has promised to deliver the world's biggest lithium-ion battery. And, you know, this is funny. This is kind of a follow-up to a Twitter war that we reported on a couple of weeks ago. So, yeah, the Twitter wars can build lithium-ion batteries, apparently.
And he did, in that Twitter war, he did promise that he will do this in 100 days or it will be free.
As soon as they sign the deal. Now, I don't know if this indicates that the deal has actually been signed, but they're going through the motions and it looks like they're going to go through with this.
I think the money's been set aside. I think that's $450 million or thereabout. And 100 days. Yeah, that's going to be really impressive. You look at the size of that thing. Doing it in 100 days. Now, I wonder, like, I don't know what the labor unions and that kind of stuff is in Australia. You think Musk's going to fly all of his own people over there and house them and stuff?
Oh, yeah. This is going to turn into a big PR win for them. It's just, it's going to be a blitzkrieg of crazy because Elon Musk is like, let's throw down. Come on. He's that kind of a showman.
Did you see his tweet about the big controversial tweet about Ambien that he made? He tweeted something like, Ambien and a glass of red wine is my way to relax or whatever. And people are like, this is irresponsible. You're a role model. You don't mix drugs with alcohol.
Sometimes you just can't turn your brain off. And it's just, there's just, I don't know. It's just kind of weird.
That you've got the formula for it there.
But this is really exciting. In South Australia, I think 1.2 million people suffer chronic type blackout type situations. And this battery is going to be 3 times larger than the world's largest lithium-ion battery. And it should alleviate those power delivery problems in that area.
If it's a big hit, you wonder if other people might be like, hey, give us the 100-day challenge.
No, I mean, it's just strictly a PR move. I mean, if he did that, it seems like that would be extra risky because at that point you've got a proven product and people should just, you know, beat a path to your door. This is totally a PR stunt. He's good at that.
He's very good at the PR. That's for sure.
An NPA panel has pitched limiting elderly drivers to cars with automatic braking technology. I wanted to be offended by this, but the more I read it, I was like, this is a really good idea.
NPA is the Japanese Police Association. And so in Japan, as we mentioned earlier, those strawberry farmers, 70 years old, that's like, now harvesting strawberries, you're like bending over.
Yeah.
Like, so 70, that's a tough job. But the people of Japan are really, really old, and they don't have a younger generation to take over those jobs because they didn't have any kids, which, bravo, Japan. I salute you for it. You know, it's you're dealing with a tough time, but you took one for the team there. So they're saying that if you're that old, and we have to admit that when you get older, reaction time suffers. You can only drive a car if it has automatic braking.
Neat. So They also were pushing for cognitive tests when it comes time to renew your driver's license because dementia and things like that. And they cite some statistics about people involved in wrecks over the age of 75 and how the percentage climbs significantly and some other factors there. And so it's like, well, maybe this isn't a terrible idea.
Yeah, they also talk about retesting, which I think is really the best idea. I think after a certain age, hey, every so many years, maybe 3 years, go in there and take that test because it should be pretty obvious if you're that far gone that you won't be able to pass the test. That seems like a pretty good idea. I mean, if you can do it for one end of the age spectrum, you can do it for the other.
Yeah, not everybody ages the same way. And, you know, not everybody can be the, you know, 150-year-old crazy eyebrows juice tiger guy because he's going to be driving until he's 150. But, you know, the other people, not so much.
I think that guy might be dead. So, now, this does bring up another thing that we've talked about a lot, which is when the time comes for self-driving cars, there's so many people's like, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to drive my car and they can pry it from my cold, dead hands. Well, they just have to legislate against you. You know, they'll just be like, well, this is safer, so we're going to do it this way. And this is exactly how that's going to roll out.
So if you're a TV network and you've got a TV show that's just not doing too well, or you have an episode of a TV show that's, you know, you remember the flashback episodes of TV shows? It's like, oh, we ran out of budget. Let's do a flashback episode. It's like,
every episode of The Sopranos is must watch. If you haven't watched The Sopranos, go and watch it right now. It's on Amazon Prime, except for the stupid dream episodes. Unwatchable. Just skip them. It's ridiculous. It made me angry when I saw those.
They do that when they run out of budget. And so those shows tend not to get very good ratings, but that can bring down the ratings overall of the entire show if you have one or two of those shows where you just kind of phone it in. Unless you get the name of the TV show slightly wrong with a typo.
Now, this is the fact that this works, first of all. Like, okay, you're the Nielsen system, right? We've built some UI, right? Why would this be a text field? Why would this not be an auto-populated field or a drop-down or something like that? You know what television shows they're running. They put out a TV guide and stuff like that. They have the on-screen...
Oh, the code number, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, y'all, just define your own show. It shows that Nielsen is perfectly fine with this because a text field, come on.
Yeah, this is a really clever, terrible way to... you'd be surprised how much you can get away with if you feign ignorance and innocence. It's like, oh, that was an innocent mistake. I totally didn't mean to do that. And meanwhile, you totally did. You can get away with a lot.
So the examples they give is stuff like nightly news, NITELY. In the past, everybody knows that this is a thing. It's sort of like an industry secret. And they would only use it when, like, let's say the NBA playoffs are going against your primetime show. You're going to get crushed. Nobody's going to watch it. So I was like, you know what? Let's not let this tiny number drag us down. Just spell it wrong. But this sort of shows how they're more and more, as TV is dying and it's more and more depressing, the whole CNN blackmail thing. Do you see that their primetime shows are getting beat by Yogi Bear reruns? What year did Yogi Bear air?
It was like the 70s, 78.
Yeah, it was like, I think it might have been early 70s. So they're getting destroyed. Nobody cares about TV anymore. And so they're cheating more and more to, you know, change these numbers.
Yay, the TV implosion honestly cannot get here fast enough. It's so amazing.
Now you might think, well, who cares? It's stupid. It's TV. Nobody cares about it. But the thing is, advertisers actually, their rate that they pay to get commercials on these shows is based on that rating.
Ah, so they're gaming the system with advertisers. Interesting, interesting. In other quantum computer news, some student researchers have successfully simulated a 45-qubit quantum circuit. So this is, they basically just use a supercomputer to simulate how a quantum computer would operate with 45 qubits, which I think was the largest simulation to date. This article will give you a little bit more background about the importance of quantum computing and how quantum computing works. But in a nutshell, each qubit that you add to the system can do computations in a superposition of all of the possible values for those bits. So a 45-qubit thing means that you can do 2 to the 45 computations simultaneously, and the answer will fall out of the system if it fits in 2 to the 45, basically.
I think... we did a story about the quantum computing a while back where they were actually, you know, it's like, here's how we build this and here's what we can accomplish. And they were doing like 3 or 6 qubits in reality. So now this is just a simulation. So, but 45 is a pretty impressive number.
The and if you didn't catch it, I think Linus went to look at D-Wave Systems, which is the leading quantum computer construction place, and so Linus has a video on the quantum computer and the stuff that goes into it, and it's pretty neat. It's really high level, but it's a really neat video, and it's a really interesting look sort of behind the curtain at D-Wave. So you should check that out if you're into quantum computing. Tesla.
The news is not all good for Tesla.
Tesla, their stock is down 20%. This is what Twitter wars get you into. It's your highs and your lows. Now, this is interesting because, what was it, June? It was June that Tesla was at an all-time high. And right. So here we are about a month later, and now it has shrunk 20%, or almost 20%, in a few different tumbles.
Now, this has to do with the whole, like, people are not buying the ability to deliver these new models on the timeline that he claims they're going to happen. And also, remember we did the story about the incredible crash test rating that they did? Well, the S did not get an incredible crash test rating. Hmm. So they actually, I think they got a bad rating, and they were like, wait, the model you tested was, something was wrong with it. Let's give you this other one. And then they tested that one. They were like, it's exactly the same. Hmm. Still not great. At least, you know, in terms of an electric car. Now, in terms of, like, compared to other cars, it's fine. But when you factor in the price and the fact that there's no engine and so on, not that impressive. And so, yeah, some of the shine, some of the bloom off the rose of the old Tesla.
The other reason that the article cited was that, you know, how many $100,000 cars do you really expect to sell worldwide? The market is getting saturated pretty much for those kinds of things in terms of winning people over to be able to do that. So Tesla's got to move into the lower areas of the market.
There's also, if you're a car buyer right now, one of the things you have to keep in mind is so when the whole subprime mortgage thing happened with houses, they kind of like, okay, we won't do that with housing for a while. Let's do it with cars. And they did it with leasing. So they put really high valuations on, you know, what, after 3 years, this car is still going to be worth a lot. And they leased a ton of cars. Well, those cars are coming off lease now, which means the used car market is going to be exploding with fairly new, decent cars. And the car market is probably going to suffer, at least in the short term, coming up pretty soon. So
maybe Tesla can switch over to some type of a lease program themselves and just cut out the middleman and earn more on the margin that way.
Yeah, but then you got to sell used Teslas.
They'll be competing with themselves. They'll cannibalize their own low-end market.
Right,
no.
Exactly.
Let's Encrypt. We love talking about Let's Encrypt. Let's Encrypt is the project that lets you get free, completely free, no strings attached, not really, encryption certificates for your websites and that kind of thing. They're adding wildcard support, which means that star.yourdomainname.com or .tech or .whatever can carry an encryption certificate.
They're all about putting HTTPS on the entire web. That's their goal, is 100%. So they took the adoption rate up from 40 to 50%, or at least you have to think they had some impact on that by giving away free keys. So their goal is 100. See if they make it. It's definitely a step in the right direction. Also, it is important to note that doesn't happen until January 2018. They're just announcing it.
They're just doing the planning. This is also great for your ISPs and any kind of like nation state actors in terms of like spying on your stuff. This will help you not be spied upon, which is really pretty great. Well, YouTube fame is bad for your health, or at least your ability to think clearly. This is really a sad and terrible story.
Yeah.
So what happened was this couple was after YouTube stardom, and this woman shot her boyfriend with a Desert Eagle from point blank range through a book because they thought a book would stop a Desert Eagle.
That's the 50 caliber Desert Eagle, one of the most powerful handgun rounds in existence. And they thought, I don't know what kind of book this was, but I got to think like even one of those like old school original Bibles that's like, you know, like that, that's not going to stop.
It's 50 cal.
Yeah, 50 caliber bullet. And it was close range. So
isn't 50 cal designed to stop like the engine block of a tank?
It will definitely do some serious damage too. Vehicles or whatever. I don't think it's a like an armor piercing round or anything like that, but it doesn't matter. It's a book and it's a lot of gunpowder. So she's been charged with manslaughter. She's out on bail. She's actually pregnant with this guy's second child. And it was all for YouTube fame. They actually tweeted out before they did it. It's like, we're doing a big dangerous stunt. Oh, everybody get hyped for that.
Wow. Did they do any dry runs or anything? I mean,
just... you would think that you would like buy two books. I don't think they did.
I don't know. That's just depressing. So PSA, don't try to get, just don't.
Don't use a gun in your YouTube videos.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you're like reviewing it or something like that, but usually those guys, they understand gun safety. If you don't understand that a 50 caliber round should not be fired at another human being ever unless you want to kill them, don't include guns in your YouTube.
Any round, really.
That's true. I wouldn't do it with a 22.
Well, the Model F is back. Now, the only reason I included this, there was some debate about including this story, but so the Model M, the greatest keyboard to ever be invented on any Earth timeline is the IBM Model M. The IBM Model M's buckling spring key design is to keyboard keys. It's the Cadillac of keyboard keys. And so you guys are probably familiar with like cherry switches, and there's different cherry switches depending on what you're after. It's super tactile because it's buckling spring. That buckling spring is to cherry as cherry is to rubber dome keyboards. It is that good. The original keyboard to use buckling spring was not the Model M, it was the Model F. And the Model F was like a zinc construction metal with plastic keys. I mean, you could literally just put a shipping label just on the keyboard and mail it, and it will be completely fine. It'll look factory when it gets there, even going through UPS, and that's saying something.
Now, that makes it very heavy, and, you know, a lot of people, it's like, oh, the greatest keyboard ever, let me get it, and you get it, it's like, Jesus Christ, what is this? Is monstrosity. But, you know, if you're into that kind of thing, this is definitely a very wanted re-release from a lot of people.
Now, it's also true that Unicomp, which is a company in Lexington, Kentucky, still makes Model M keyboards using a lot of the original equipment. They've actually recently, some of my people have talked to the guy that runs the show there, and they sell a lot of Model M keyboards to the enterprise. The medical industry, for example, still uses a lot of Model M keyboards, things like MRI machines, stuff like that. They have tooled up to be antimicrobial. And there are versions of the Model M. Some of the middle-aged ones from Unicomp, I, in my personal opinion, had quality control issues. The keyboard controller was not that great. Not quite as good as the original Model M's, but they've recently redone their tooling, and things are pretty good around the Model M. The lingering problems with the Model M are that it doesn't do in-key rollover. You can do some mods, but you don't want to do them. The mods are sketchy at best because you got to switch to analog mode for reading the key combinations, and so you basically are building a custom controller at that point. It's not a lot of fun. The Model F uses a printed circuit board for its key layout. Now, unlike Cherry, where each individual key can be manufactured and then you just arrange them, it's really difficult to do that with buckling spring because you need to pack the components in so tightly. So you got to basically do a keyboard at a time instead of a key at a time with Cherry. So it has not really lended itself to mass production. This guy has put $100,000 into tooling, and he's already taken $250,000 on pre-orders on the Model F. The Model F is a. I like the Model M better than the Model F. I have both. I have a pretty vast Model M collection from all eras and the variants of the Model M. But you should totally check it out. I'm so excited about this keyboard. And Ryan's like, oh Jesus, can get on with it. We're already running long. Just no, there's no news. We don't care. We don't know what's going on.
Is it still PS2 only?
No, there are USB controllers. Like, if you buy from Unicomp, the PCKeyboard.com.
I'm talking about this one.
It's totally modernized. So you get some features that you don't have on the old one. They've changed a few things in terms of like the key layout, and you get the extra Windows key or the Meta key or the operating system specific key or whatever you want. So they've made some changes to sort of modernize it a little bit. So it's pretty neat. And then, oh, you know, we didn't name the gardening robot. What would we name the gardening robot?
CD
the robot. Well, what do we name this robot? Because this is much more horrifying. Robots. I mean, just
this is not a specific sex robot. This story is about a report released by, what do they call themselves? Something Foundation for Responsible Robotics. Now, and the topic is sex robots, which is, you know, that's a great headline, right? Sex robots. Now, they did bring up, so you talk about sex robots, it's like, it's going to happen, nothing you can do about it. It seems harmless. I can't think
from the sounds of the article, they're already here and they're in Japan.
Yeah, yeah. So, but they did bring up something that never even occurred to me, like in a million years. child sex robots.
There's a guy arrested in the UK for that.
And it's like, wow, that's not going to happen. And then you read a little bit further, and again, it already exists, and they're importing them. So the question is, what's the morality of a child sex robot? So I guess they're illegal already, at least in Ireland.
I am not qualified to answer that question.
I'm gonna take a risk, and I'm going to go ahead and take a position on this. They're not right.
There's something that's not right about that, but I mean, I don't know. I don't know. Are there the report here talks of, it mentions is like, you know, psychologically, maybe that's better than real people, but then somebody else is saying, well, you know, another psychologist says, well, you know, you don't get rid of racism and bigotry by tolerating it behind closed doors. So, you know, in certain scenarios, so I don't know. And yeah. I don't know. That's above my pay grade.
Now, they do also bring up the whole idea of, like, you know, feminism, and are you removing the value of women, which to me seems inherently sexist. Aren't we saying that that's the only value of women if a sex robot can replace them? I don't agree with that. I'm sure there's going to be male sex robots. Maybe.
I don't know.
The same way that there's male prostitutes. Hey, gay dudes need a sex robot too. So, yeah, some interesting questions. But the sex robots, I think the big thing to take away here is they're here, and they're coming soon to shore near you.
They're here. What do we do now? It's like, Oh, this is not good. That was, I didn't really care for Spielberg and Kubrick's AI, the movie. Overall, but there were sex robots in that movie. I think one of the robots that left was like a derelict sex robot movie or sex robot something or other. And you know, there were some themes like that raised there in that. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is sort of an interesting article, and you should check it out if you want a sex robot. I don't know. I mean, this is just going to be crazy. I mean, I feel like the Associated Press, you know, auto robot thing that we were talking about earlier, it's like, you know, man found with sex robot, that would immediately be written about by another robot and carried by, you know, your local news story or whatever.
It's going to be huge. It's going to be a huge industry. I mean, you know, as much as you joke about it, you think about like all the waifu pillows and all that kind of garbage. And
all the pillows.
It's going to be, you know, it's just an upgraded version of that. And there's going to be licensing, you know,
it's Hatsune Miku,
exactly, right. It's going to be a huge industry, and there are going to be a lot of questions about it. So
I've got the full Sailor Moon collection.
Exactly. Well, but here's the thing about it though, like, wouldn't you just make it modular? So like,
you just have to get some components.
Yeah, dress it different. I think that's the way to go.
I've got a question. Is there some sort of like made robot on the way to sex robots? Like, can we have a robot that cleans your house? Because I would be all about that.
Why not both? I mean, realistically, how many hours of the day are you having sex with the sex robot? I think it's going to need to multitask.
That would certainly make it more attractive economically.
Or it could be like the farming robots, and you could timeshare it.
Timeshare sex robots. You heard it here first on the Level One News.
That needs to be the title for this week's news episode. Timeshare sex robots. That is clickbait as it can get.
And we're so sorry for the clickbait, but you know what? It works. Well, I think that's definitely the last story of this week's news. I don't have it in me to do anything else.
You can't top that. You have to end it there, because anything after that, it's just going to be ignored anyway.
Oh, we'll see you next Tuesday. We just did a monitor review on Korean monitors. You should check that out. It's an ultra-wide, 95 hertz. We've got some content coming up on user experience design and some other fun stuff, so be sure to check that out. And thanks to our patrons for making this available in a podcast form. We'll see you next week.
See ya.